The Moon and Sixpence, dramatized in four parts by Jeffrey Siegel from the novel by W. Somerset Maugham, with Ronald Pickup as Maugham himself and Patrick Allen as Charles Strickland, a character inspired by the real-life painter Paul Gauguin. Part 1, Flight from London.
I confess that when, all those years ago, I first made acquaintance with Charles Strickland, I never for a moment discerned that there was in him anything out of the ordinary. Yet now there are few to be found who will deny his genius. For me, however, the most interesting thing in art is the personality of the artist, and I think it is accepted that even the most insignificant of Strickland's works suggests a personality which is strange, tormented, and complex. It is this, surely, which prevents even those who do not like his pictures from being indifferent to them. It is this which has excited so curious an interest in his life and character. Much has been written of the man and his work, but as he made enemies rather than friends, it is not strange that those who write of him should eke out their scanty recollections with a lively fancy and so give rise to a legend which a wise historian would hesitate to attack. A wise historian, however, was precisely what his son, the Reverend Robert Strickland, was not.
And in penning this biography of my father, it is my avowed intention to remove certain misconceptions which have gained currency in regard to the latter part of his life, and which have caused considerable pain to certain persons living, not the least important of these being his wife, my mother. Charles Strickland was, in fact, a man of kindly temper, industrious habits, and moral disposition, and it is worthy of note that, writing from Paris, he described my mother as an excellent woman.
True. But a facsimile of that very letter, published soon after in a rival biography, actually read,
"God damn my wife. She is an excellent woman. I wish she was in hell."
When so much has been written about Charles Strickland, it may seem unnecessary that I should write more. However, it is true I knew him more intimately than most. Indeed, I met him first before ever he became a painter. The Great War not only tore its ugly gash across the soil of Europe, it stands as a barrier, a divide, cutting us off from earlier attitudes. Thus it was in 1902, a younger, more bashful, indeed more innocent edition of myself, who, having written my first book, which by a lucky chance had excited some attention, was drawn into the genteel bohemia of Hampstead and Notting Hill Gate and High Street, Kensington.
It's all true, of course, Mr. Moore.
I beg your pardon?
Your book. It must be.
Well,
I can recognize authenticity. I defy any writer to get things just so in the way that you do without having actually experienced them.
I don't know about that. Obviously, one's own experience comes into it.
Oh, come on, old man. I recognized a good half of the people in it. Met first.
No, surely not. And what about the creative imagination?
What about it? All right in its place, I grant you, but we don't need too much of it.
I can't agree. What are authors for, if not to open magic casements?
Open magic cash boxes would be nearer the truth.
Philistine.
Maybe, but a realist too. Authors don't live by words alone.
I say, that reminds me, you were thinking of changing your agent. What happened?
Oh, he earned a reprieve. Pulled off rather a good American deal.
Oh, who with?
Too early days to reveal all.
No. I only ask because I wonder if you've heard any rumours about that fellow's...
Never listen to rumours. Start them, maybe, but listen to them never. What do you say, Maugham?
Well, have some bread and butter.
Oh, thanks. Wondered why you were holding that plate.
There you are, Mr. Maugham. Do come with me. Somebody specially wants to meet you. Take the plate from him, Basil.
With pleasure. No, what was this?
Well, you never listened to
it. It's nice of you to hand things round, but you don't have to, you know.
It gives me something to do.
You're bored, oh dear.
Oh, no, 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 Miss Waterford. It's just that, well, in situations like that, I never know what to say.
You'll soon learn.
They either say witty things or...
Or stupid things.
Or things to which there's no answer.
Well, none of those apply in this case. I want you to meet Mrs. Strickland.
Ah, should I know her? I mean, is she a writer?
Oh, no, she doesn't do anything like that.
Oh, what does she do?
She gives luncheon parties, good ones. And she's raving about your book.
The Lion Hunter. I don't know that
you
I'm very good...
You only have to roar a little. Do that and she'll soon invite you. Oh. Here he is, Mrs. Strickland. You can tell him yourself.
How do you do?
How do you do, Mr. Moore? Oh, it's so nice to meet you. I've only just finished your book and... Well,
Miss Waterford says you enjoyed it.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did very much indeed. And if I may say so without being patronizing, for a young man to show such sensitivity, such awareness. Please forgive me. I am being patronizing.
Not at all. I'm delighted that you liked it so much.
I do. I do.
Mr. Morm's a neighbour of yours, you know.
Really?
I have rooms not far from Victoria Station.
Oh, we're quite near there. We're in Ashley Gardens, overlooking the site of the new cathedral.
Very noisy at the moment, I should think.
Perhaps. But it will be a very fine building.
Let's hope so.
We met Mr. Bentley, the architect, you know. He showed us some of the drawings. It will be a splendid neighbour.
For you both, eh, Mr. Morm?
It will certainly enhance the neighbourhood.
You must come to luncheon, Mr. Morm. Let me have your address.
The invitation arrived a few days later. On the day, for fear of being too early, I walked 3 times round the uncompleted cathedral, and as a consequence, when I arrived, I found all the other guests already at table. They were all writers, although only one or two of them were known to me, and then only slightly. Save that is for Rose Waterford, who had, after all, engineered my presence. She was in high spirits. In fact, I never heard her more malicious about our common friends. Of the others present, those whose brilliancy was already a byword, only opened their mouths to put food in. The remainder, with lesser reputations for wit, kept things bubbling. Mrs. Strickland herself did not talk much, but she had a pleasant gift for keeping the conversation general. And when there was a rare pause, she threw in just the right remark to set things going once more. She was at that time about 36 or 37, and although not pretty, her face was pleasing, chiefly on account of her kind brown eyes. Her dining room was in the good taste of the period, with Whistler etchings in neat black frames on the green walls. The green curtains, with their peacock design, hung in straight lines right down to the green carpet, all suggesting the influence of William Morris. At that time, there must have been 500 dining rooms in London decorated in exactly the same manner. It was chaste, artistic, and dull. Rose Waterford and I left together. The fine day and the new hat she was wearing persuaded us to saunter through the park.
That was a nice party.
Did you think the food was good? I told her if she wanted writers, she must feed them well.
Admirable advice. But why does she want them?
Well, I suppose she finds them amusing. She wants to be in the movement. I fancy she's rather simple, poor dear, and she thinks we're all wonderful.
Simple or not, there's one aspect of her character I find most appealing.
What's that?
I think she has the gift of sympathy. One could pour out one's trouble to her and be sure of comfort.
Dangerous.
How so?
Something a little ghoulish about ready listeners. One often detects a certain avidity with which they pounce on the misfortunes of others.
What a cynic you are, Rose.
And how innocent you are.
Not at all. I recognize the milk of human kindness when I see it.
Well, milk is very nice, especially with a drop of brandy in it. But the cow is only too glad to be rid of it.
You've a blistering tongue, you know.
Yes, I know. Still, in the case of Amy Strickland, I'll grant you she's one of the most harmless of lion hunters, and I really quite like her.
What's her history? Where's she from?
Oh, the country somewhere. A quiet childhood, I gather, but with a passion for reading. She says the books that used to come down from Mudie's library were her salvation.
Has she now given up books for authors?
No. In fairness, she's still a great reader and knows something about it, which is rare enough.
But for all that, she's dazzled to think herself a part of the literary scene.
Yes, but not to the extent of aping its eccentricities.
In fact, it could be that there's a tiny reserve there somewhere that sees us as an entertainment.
It's possible. She may not be quite so simple after all.
Mm. Is there a Mr. Strickland?
Oh, yes. He's something in the city. A stockbroker. He's very dull. Mm.
Are they good friends?
They adore one another. You'll meet him if you dine there. Mind you, she doesn't often have people to dinner. He's not in the least interested in literature or the arts.
Why do nice women marry dull men?
Because intelligent men won't marry nice women.
Ah. Well, how about children?
There's a boy and a girl. They're both at school.
This is Robert, taken at the beginning of this term.
A cricketer, I see.
Yes. He's quite keen.
And he's where?
At rugby. Hence the tailcoat and stand-up collar.
What is he, about 15, 16?
16 and 3 months.
Nice-looking lad.
We think so. I don't know that he's very clever, but I know he's good. He has a charming character. So is Charlotte, but she bubbles more.
And this is Charlotte?
Yes. Taken about the same time. She's 14.
They're both the image of you.
Yes. I do think they're more like me than their father.
Why have you never let me meet him?
Would you like to? He's not at all literary. In fact, bless him, he's a perfect Philistine.
He's in the city, I believe.
On the stock exchange. And he's a typical broker. I think he'd bore you to death.
Does he bore you?
I happen to be his wife. And I'm very fond of him.
Ah.
You don't think that's...
What?
Oh, I don't know. Do you write? Is it? Must seem very tame. But he's just... Well, my husband. He doesn't pretend to be anything special. He doesn't even make much money on the stock exchange. But he's good and kind.
I think I should like him very much.
I'll ask you to dine with us quietly sometime, but it's at your own risk. You'll have a very dull evening.
In the event, it was far from the quiet dinner party she had envisaged. The invitation, which came within the next 2 or 3 days, was to fill a gap that very evening, one of her guests having failed her. Our relationship by now was evidently such that she felt sure of my not taking offence. The occasion was a purely social function, the guests being in the main those to whom the Stricklands owed a dinner, and who in all likelihood accepted in the same spirit as the Stricklands had accepted their invitations. But I did at least meet her husband.
This is Mr. Morgan, Charles.
How do you do?
How do you do?
I think he was beginning to doubt that I really had a husband.
Yes, well, as you see. Excuse me.
And this is my sister, Mrs. McAndrew.
How do you do?
And Colonel McAndrew.
How do you do?
Oh, you're one of Amy's writers, I believe.
The, for want of a better word, duty guests included a KC and his wife, a government official and his wife, and the wife of an MP whose husband's absence at the last moment was the reason for my presence and whom I took in to dinner. Everyone talked a little louder and more animatedly than was necessary in an instinctive desire to make the party go. But the conversation was not general. Each person talked only to those in his immediate vicinity.
It's my husband's opinion we'll never have another Prime Minister in the Lords.
More's the pity. Still, I suppose it's all right so long as he's a gentleman. What do you say, Charles?
I should say you're very probably right.
It's difficult, though, these days to define exactly what a gentleman is. Mm-hmm. At least so far as the House of Commons is concerned.
You're right there. The same applies to the army.
I think, ladies, we might leave the gentlemen to their port and cigars now. Coffee in 15 minutes, Charles.
Yes, very good, my dear. Well, do help yourselves, gentlemen.
Thank you.
No, I won't port.
This port's damn good, Charles. Where'd you get it?
To our usual people, I think.
It's damn good. Of course, we know vintages vary, but it's not bad at all.
The conversation continued in similar vein. As no one was in the least concerned with me, I took the opportunity to consider my host. Charles Strickland was a bigger man than I'd expected, broad and heavy, with large hands, and he wore his evening clothes clumsily. He was a man of about 40, not good-looking, and yet not ugly, for his features were rather good. But they were all a little larger than life-size, and the effect was ungainly. I no longer wondered that Mrs. Strickland felt a certain embarrassment about him. He was a worthy enough member of society, an honest broker, a good husband and father, but scarcely such as to be a credit to a woman who wanted to make herself a position in the world of art and letters. Still, Mrs. Strickland was a charming woman, and she loved him. I pictured their future lives troubled by no untoward adventures. How wrong I was is well known. But when I reflect on all that happened later, I ask myself if I was thick-witted not to see that there was in Charles Strickland at least something out of the common. Perhaps I should not have been surprised when, in the early autumn of that same year, after an absence from London, I ran across Rose Waterford in Jermyn Street.
You're looking very gay and sprightly, Rose.
Am I?
What's the matter with you?
There, I thought it was all compliment and you've spoilt it.
There's also a malicious glint in your eye. Someone's in trouble.
Worse and worse. But you're right. Oh, perhaps you've heard.
No, not that I know of, but then I'm only just back in town.
Charles Strickland. Well, you did meet him, didn't you?
Yes. What's happened to him? I'm not hammered on the stock exchange.
Not that I know of. But he has run away from his wife.
What?
Isn't it dreadful?
But... No, I can't believe it.
I assure you it's true.
But he's... He's much too dull.
Oh, Carmen, you were right, Don't you realise it's the apparently dull ones that are all volcanic beneath the surface?
I grant you that, and it happens all the time in books. Otherwise, where should we be?
Well, here's life catching up with us.
But why? How?
I know nothing but the bare facts. But I have heard that a young person in a city tea shop has left her situation.
You told me. But, good God, the man must be over 40.
Tell me, where would you put the limit for a man to fall in love? 35?
Well, you know what I mean.
I think so.
Oh, my God.
What now?
I'm due to call on Mrs. Strickland this afternoon. Well, I wrote to say I'd be back and that unless I heard to the contrary, I would come and take a dish of tea with her.
And you haven't heard?
No, but that's hardly surprising in the circumstances.
Well, then you must go and find out exactly what happened.
Well, how can I, knowing what you've just told me?
But if you don't go, she'll assume you know all about it and are shunning her.
And if I go knowing, she'll think I've come to pry.
Or help. She may be glad to see a friendly face.
Mind you, I should be interested to see... Well, first, if it's true, and secondly...
How she's taking it?
Damn it, yes.
Then why not call as arranged and be in complete ignorance? Either she'll send you away or she'll tell you all about it and you can be surprised and then sympathetic.
Rose, you are utterly unprincipled. But I think that's just what I'll do. I wasn't quite sure, Mrs. Strickland, if you'd had my note, whether you were expecting me.
Oh, of course I was. Tea will be here at any moment.
Ah.
You remember my brother-in-law, Colonel MacAndrew?
Oh, yes, indeed.
You met at dinner here just before the holidays.
Mm.
I'm sorry it's so dark in here, but it's not long since we came back from Norfolk, and things have not been put out again properly yet.
Not at all. The sun is so bright anyway. Especially considering it's already autumn. But if you've so recently returned, I'm sure you'll want
to... No, really, Mr. Moore. I'm delighted to see you. I had your letter and was expecting you, so... Ah. Here's tea. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, ma'am.
I think I'd prefer a whiskey and soda, if you don't mind.
Not at all. Help yourself, Fred, won't you?
Yeah.
Tea for you, Mr. Moore, or would you prefer whiskey?
No, tea, please.
I think you'd better have one too, Emmy.
No, thank you. I prefer tea. There, Mr. Morgan.
Thank you.
You too were away for the whole of the summer.
Yes. I think London this year was particularly oppressive.
And you were free?
Oh, I took some work with me, but it was largely a holiday.
Oh, forgive me. Will you have something to eat? Some bread and butter?
No, thank you. Tea's fine.
Perhaps you'd like a cigarette. The box should be here.
It's all right. I have my case.
No. No, you mustn't smoke your own. Where is that box? It must be here.
Really, please.
Oh, it's empty. I'm afraid there are none. I'm afraid I always leave it too.
I dare say you'd like me to go.
I suppose you've heard that blackguard has deserted her.
I did vaguely hear something. You know how people gossip.
He's bolted. Gone off to Paris. With a woman.
I'm awfully sorry.
He's left Amy without a penny.
Look, I'm sure she doesn't want to be bothered with me just now.
Not a penny.
Will you tell her how sorry I am and, well, if there's anything I can do,
I don't know what's to become of her. And the children? Are they going to live on air? 17 years.
17 years?
They've been married. I never liked him, you know. But he was my brother-in-law, and I made the best of it. And he wasn't a gentleman. Did you think he was a gentleman?
Is it absolutely final, do you think?
There's only one thing. She must divorce him. I was telling her when you came in. Fire in with your petition, Amy. You owe it to yourself and you owe it to the children. That's my advice.
Well, if it is certain...
Get rid of the blackguard once for all. Better not let me catch sight of him. I'd thrash him within an inch of his life.
Oh, Mrs. Strickland.
I'm so glad you didn't go away, and I'm sorry I broke down.
Oh, not at all. In the circumstances...
Are people talking about it?
I've only just come back, as you know.
You've heard nothing, then?
Well, the only person I've seen is Rose Waterford.
Tell me exactly what she said. I particularly want to know.
Oh, you know the way people talk, and Rose is not very reliable, is she?
What did she say?
She said your husband had left you.
She didn't say anything about his going with anyone?
No. Oh, no.
That's all I wanted to know.
I really am very sorry.
Thank you.
And, well, if there's anything... if I can be of any use to you, please...
I don't know that anyone can do anything for me. But thank you, and thank you for coming, Mr. Moore.
Oh, not at all. Goodbye.
If you're walking up Victoria Street, I'll come along with you.
Oh, right.
We don't know who the woman is. All we know is that the blackguard's gone to Paris.
I thought they got on so well.
Well, so they did. Why, just before you arrived, Amy was saying they'd never had a quarrel in the whole of their married life.
It seems so...
Well, you know, Amy, there never was a better woman in the world.
Did you say she suspected nothing?
Not a thing.
It was as sudden as that?
Not an inkling, nothing. They'd taken a house in Norfolk, and he spent August there with her and the children. We were down there for 2 or 3 days, my wife and I. I played golf with him. He was just the same as he's always been.
But then, when?
He came back to town at the beginning of September to let his partner go away, and Amy stayed on. At the end of the tenancy, she wrote to say what day she'd be coming back to London. And he replied from Paris. He said he'd made up his mind not to live with her anymore.
Oh, heavens.
Yes.
What explanation did he give?
My dear fellow, he gave no explanation at all. His letter was no more than 10 lines. I've seen it.
It's extraordinary.
Not really. After all, what explanation could he give? Except that he'd gone off with a woman.
Yes, I suppose you're right.
And he probably thought she'd find that out for herself anyway. That's the sort of chap he was.
What's Mrs. Strickland going to do?
Well, the first thing to do is to get our proofs. I shall go to Paris myself.
What about his business?
Ah, well, that's where he's been artful. He's been drawing his horns in for the past year.
Did he tell his partner he was leaving?
Not a word. The fellow's hopping mad about it, I can tell you. Apparently, he stands to find himself £400 or £500 out of pocket.
What's he going to do about that?
I gather he's considering proceedings. Fortunately, the furniture in the flat is all in Amy's name, so it can't be touched. At least she'll have that.
Did you mean it, then, when you said that she wouldn't have any money?
I certainly did. All she's got is £200 or £300 and the furniture.
How's she going to live?
God knows. It's a shocking business.
My vague offer to Mrs. Strickland to do what I could to help was made, I suppose, as a gesture of commiseration, or as an unmeant social phrase uttered merely to enable me the more easily to take my leave. At any rate, I don't think I expected her to take me up on it. Nevertheless, a day or two later, I received a note from her asking me to call. Her black dress, simple to austerity, suggested her bereaved condition. And I have to confess a certain astonishment that, notwithstanding her obvious emotion, she was still concerned to dress the part she was playing. Nor was I in any way prepared for the request she was to make of me.
Will you go over to Paris and see Charlie?
I?
Fred, Colonel McAndrew, is set on going, and I'm afraid he's never the man for such a task. In fact, I'm quite sure he'd only make things worse. And I don't know who else to ask.
But I've not spoken 10 words to your husband. He doesn't know me. He'll probably tell me to go to the devil.
That wouldn't hurt you. Actually, I think it's rather an advantage that he doesn't know you.
Oh?
He's never really liked Fred. He thinks him a fool. He doesn't understand soldiers. Fred would fly into a passion and there'd be a quarrel, and things would be worse instead of better. If you said you came on my behalf, he couldn't refuse to listen to you.
Yes, but... Well, I haven't known you very long, and him, as I say, hardly at all. Why don't you go and see him yourself?
You forget. He isn't alone.
No. No, I see that. Well, look, if I were to go, I ought to know some details. I don't want to pry, but...
Oh, of course. Only, what can I tell you? Where shall I begin?
I gather you've been married 17 years.
Yes. And that's why it was all so unexpected. I never dreamt that Charlie was the sort of man to get infatuated with anyone. We always got on so well together.
Oh, that was the impression I had.
I'm making such a fool of myself.
No, really, I...
Of course, I had a great many interests he didn't share, but he never minded that.
How did you first meet?
Oh, on holiday. At Eastbourne. Nothing could have been more ordinary. I was 20. My father always took the family there during August. We normally lived in the depths of the country. He and my mother settled there after he retired from the Indian Civil Service, and... Our annual visit to the seaside was our principal taste of metropolitan delights.
And your husband was on holiday too?
Yes, on his own. He was a few years older than I, and we did all the usual things. Played tennis, walked on the front, listened to the minstrels. We met a few more times afterwards, and he proposed. I'd already made up my mind to accept him, and we were married. We set up house in London, first in Hampstead, and then we moved here, into town. Then the children came, and now this.
And you'd no hints that anything like this might... Well, there was no warning.
None. Nothing at all. It was like a thunderbolt.
Just a letter?
Yes. It's here.
I was glad to have the opportunity of seeing it. It was brief and to the point, and in fact its clumsy bluntness fitted well with the impression I had formed of Charles Strickland.
My dear Amy, I think you'll find everything all right in the flat. I've given instructions and dinner will be ready for you and the children when you get home. I shall not be there to meet you. I've made up my mind to live apart from you, and I'm going to Paris in the morning. I shall post this letter on my arrival. I shall not come back. My decision is irrevocable. Yours always, Charles Strickland.
Not a word of explanation or regret. It's inhuman.
It's a very strange letter. Well,
of course, he's not himself. I don't know who this woman is who's got hold of him, but it's made him into another man.
You haven't found out who she... who the person might be?
No. No one seems to have any idea. Generally, when a married man falls in love with someone, people see them about together, lunching or something, and her friends can't wait to come and tell the wife. But in this case, all we can be sure of is that it's been going on for a long time.
Oh? What makes you think that?
Fred found that out. My husband used to go to his club 3 or 4 nights a week, so far as I knew, to play bridge. Fred happens to know one of the members who was quite surprised and told him he'd never seen Charles in the card room. So when we thought he was at his club, it's quite clear he was with her.
Yeah, I see. Oh, by the way, what about the children? It must have been very difficult to explain to them.
I haven't said a word to either of them. After all, it was only a day or so before they were due back at school. I told them their father had been called away on business.
Ah, yes.
He always seemed so fond of them. Even if he was tired of me, I wonder how he had the heart to leave them. What's going to happen to them, poor darlings? How are we going to live?
Oh, of course, sir. I'll go over to Paris if you think I can do any good, but you must tell me exactly what you want me to do.
I want him to come back.
I understood from Colonel McAndrew that you'd made up your mind to divorce him.
I'll never divorce him. Hmm? You can tell him that from me. He'll never be able to marry that woman. I can be as obstinate as he can.
Are you in love with him still?
I don't know. I want him to come back. If he'll do that, we'll let bygones be bygones.
I'm to tell him that?
Yes. After all, we have been married for 17 years. I'm a broad-minded woman, I think. Oh, and I wouldn't have cared what he did so long as I knew nothing about it. If he'll come back now, everything can be smoothed over and no one will know a thing.
And that's what you want me to tell him?
Yes. That's what I want you to tell him.
Very well. Oh, wait, where should I find him? Do we have an address?
Yes. There wasn't one on the letter, but he did tell his partner.
What is it?
He's at an hotel. The Hôtel des Belges. I don't know.
Nor I.
But Fred does. He says it's very expensive. So there he is, having a luxurious time with her. But it can't go on, not at his age. After all, he's 40. All right, I could understand it in a young man, but it's terrible in a man of his years. With children who are nearly grown up. His health will never stand it.
I...
Philbert, tell him.
Mm-hmm.
Tell him that our home cries out for him. That his room is exactly as it was when he left it. It's waiting for him. Talk to him about the past. All we've been through together. Say, what am I to tell the children when they ask about him? Tell him that I can't live without him. That I'd sooner kill myself. Please. Please do everything you can for me.
I could not fail to be moved by the intensity of her appeal. I was extraordinarily touched. I would certainly do all I could to bring him back. I would leave for Paris the next day and stay there until I had achieved something. During the journey, however, my uncritical enthusiasm waned a little. Reflecting, I found I was puzzled by certain contradictions in Mrs. Strickland's behaviour. She was, of course, very unhappy. But to excite my sympathy, she was able to make a show of her unhappiness. She had seen to it that she was provided with a sufficiency of handkerchiefs, and while I admired her forethought, it did in retrospect make her tears perhaps a little less moving. And I could not decide whether she desired the return of her husband because she loved him, or because she dreaded the tongue of scandal. I had not yet learned how contradictory is human nature, and that both reasons might be equally valid and legitimate. But for all that, there was something of an adventure in my trip, and I saw myself from a dramatic standpoint in the role of a trusted friend, charged with bringing back the contrite husband to his forgiving wife, and by the sheer force of his persuasion, succeeding hands down. The first slight setback came, however, with the discovery that the Hôtel des Belges, far from being a large and sumptuous establishment at the back of the Rue de Rivoli, was in fact a tall, shabby building in a mean street on the edge of Montmartre. It had obviously not been painted for years, and had so bedraggled an air that the houses on each side of it looked neat and clean. It could not possibly be here that Charles Strickland was living in guilty splendour with his unknown charmer. Nevertheless, I owed it to Mrs. Strickland to make sure.
Monsieur?
Oui, monsieur?
I'm looking for... je cherche Monsieur Strickland.
L'anglais.
Pardon?
Il est anglais. English.
Yes. You mean he is staying here?
32, au sixième.
Oh. Monsieur Strickland est là?
Oui, allez monter. 32. Certitude.
Thank you. Merci. By the way, est-ce que madame est là aussi?
Madame? Il n'y a pas de madame.
Oh.
Monsieur est seul.
The concierge looked at me suspiciously as I began the long climb to the sixth floor. And well you might, for I have no doubt that my expression and demeanour all too clearly betrayed the doubt and uncertainty I was beginning to feel. This was already far from what I'd been expecting. The stairs were dark and airless. There was a foul and musty smell. And by the time I reached the sixth floor, the light which filtered through the grimy, crusted skylight was just enough to enable me to pick out room number 32.
Hello?
You won't remember me, but I had the pleasure of dining with you last July.
Come in.
Thank you.
Take a pew. Sorry, just a minute. Chuck those clothes on the floor.
Thanks.
What can I do for you?
I've come to see you on behalf of your wife.
I was just going out to have a drink before dinner. You'd better come too. Do you like absinthe?
I can drink it.
Why don't we dine together? You owe me a dinner, you know.
Certainly. Are you alone?
Yes. In point of fact, I've not spoken to a soul in 3 days. My French isn't exactly brilliant. Come on, then.
Thank you.
I see you know what to do. The absinthe, dripping the water through the spoon of sugar.
Yes, well, I was here as a student.
As I've just learnt. My principal discovery since I've been here.
But you've been to Paris before.
Yes, we came on our honeymoon, but I haven't been since.
On earth did you find that hotel?
It was recommended to me. I wanted something cheap.
I see. Well, I ought to tell you at once why I've come to see you.
I thought someone would come along sooner or later. I've had a lot of letters from Amy.
Then you'll know what I've got to say.
I've not read them.
Has it occurred to you that your wife is frightfully unhappy?
She'll get over it.
Does she deserve that you should treat her like this?
Nope.
Have you any complaints to make against her?
None.
And isn't it monstrous to leave her in this fashion without a fault to find with her?
Monstrous?
Well, if you acknowledge that, there doesn't seem much more to be said.
I don't think there is.
Hang it all, one can't leave a woman without a bond.
Why not?
How's she going to live?
Well, I've supported her for 17 years. Why shouldn't she support herself for a change?
She can't.
Let her try.
Don't you care for her anymore?
Not a bit.
Well, then, damn it all, what about your children? They've never done you any harm. They didn't ask to be brought into the world. If you chuck everything like this, they'll be thrown on the streets.
Oh, they've had a good many years of comfort, more probably than the majority of children have. Oh, besides, somebody will look after them. When it comes to the point, the McAndrews will pay for their schooling.
Aren't you fond of them? You can't just want to have nothing more to do with them.
I liked them all right when they were kids, but now they're growing up, I've no particular feeling for them.
It's just in humour.
I dare say.
You don't seem in the least ashamed.
I'm not.
Well, at least the law will offer them some form of protection. You know you can be forced to support your wife and children.
Can the law get blood out of a stone? I've no money.
What do you mean?
I've got £100.
£100? What are you going to do when that's gone?
Earn some more.
Look, you can't possibly expect me to believe...
Anyway, why doesn't Amy marry again? She's comparatively young, not unattractive. She wants to divorce me. I don't mind giving her the necessary ground.
Ah, I see. Well, you can put that right out of your head. Your wife says that nothing you can do will ever induce her to divorce you.
Oh, well, not to please yourself. Doesn't matter a tuppenny damn to me one way or the other.
Now, you mustn't think us such fools as all that. We happen to know you came away with a woman.
Oh, no. Oh, poor Amy.
I don't see anything very amusing in that.
What poor minds women have got. Love, it's always love. A man can only leave one woman because he wants another. Do you think I'd be such a fool as to do what I've done for a woman?
Do you mean to say you didn't leave your wife for another woman?
Of course not.
On your word of honour?
On my word of honour.
Then what in God's name have you left her for?
I want to paint.
But you're 40.
That's what made me think it was high time to begin.
Have you ever painted before?
I rather wanted to be a painter when I was a boy. But my father made me go into business, said there was no money in art. I began to paint a bit about a year ago. For the last year, I've been going to some classes at night.
That's where you went when your wife thought you were playing bridge at your club?
Yes, that's it.
Why didn't you tell her?
I preferred not to.
Can you paint?
Not yet. But I shall. That's why I've come over here. I couldn't get what I wanted in London. Perhaps I can here.
At your age, most men begin painting at, what, 18?
I can learn quicker than I could when I was 18.
What makes you think you have any talent?
I've got to paint.
Aren't you taking an awful chance?
How old are you? 27, 28? What you do isn't exactly safe as the Bank of England.
Oh, that's beside the point.
Is it?
Oh, a miracle may happen. You may be a great painter, but you must confess that the chances are a million to one against.
I've got to paint.
All right, then. Suppose you're never anything more than third rate. Will it have been worthwhile giving up everything? In other walks of life, it doesn't matter if you're just adequate. You get along quite comfortably, but it's different if you're an artist.
Well, you're not only young, you're a fool as well.
If it is folly to state the obvious...
I tell you, I've got to paint. When a man falls in the water, it doesn't matter if he swims well or badly. He's got to get out or he'll drown.
You won't go back to your wife?
Never.
She's willing to forget everything that's happened and start afresh.
She can go to hell.
You don't care if she and your children have to beg their bread?
Not a damn.
You are a most unmitigated cad.
Now that you've got that off your chest, let's order our dinner.
I dare say that the most seemly thing I could have done at this point was to leave him there and then. Or at the very least make some show of the indignation I felt. And I'm sure that Colonel MacAndrew would have thought well of me if I'd been able to report my stout refusal to sit and dine at the same table with a man of such character. But the fear of not being able to carry it through effectively has always made me shy of assuming the moral attitude. And in this case, the certainty that my sentiments would be lost on Strickland made it particularly embarrassing to utter them. Moreover, the complete unexpectedness of his situation and my inability to understand his motives encouraged my curiosity to prevail. So, having drunk together, we dined together.
Enjoyed that, did you?
Yes, it was a very good meal. Didn't you?
I suppose so. But what I eat isn't all that important to me. Never has been.
It's not just what, though, is it? It's how. Where?
What do you mean?
Well, here, for example, a pavement cafe in Paris.
Yes?
Paris. Uniquely itself. I can never come here without feeling that I'm on the verge of adventure.
Oh.
You don't feel anything like that.
I don't know what I feel. I don't care. I'm here because... Well, because I think this place will give me what I want.
That's all... I say, do you know that girl?
Hmm? What girl?
At the table over there with the flowers in her hat.
Well, she's a whore, isn't she?
I don't know. She's pretty and she seems to know you.
Tch.
Well, that made your feelings pretty plain.
I'm taking a smile off her face anyway.
It was a very pleasant smile, and anyway, it was something of a compliment.
I didn't come here for that. I could have got all the women I wanted in London.
I do beg your pardon. Tell me, have you started yet? Doing any painting?
Yes. I've begun at a studio.
And?
Only in the last few days. In fact, I didn't see the master till this morning. He came round while we were at work. When he saw my drawing, he just raised his eyebrows and walked on.
What about the class you attended back home? What did they think about your work?
They thought it was a joke.
I just don't understand.
Nor do I.
Is it some deep-seated instinct for creation that stockbroking doesn't satisfy?
Could be.
Well, I can see that it's not the most exciting of callings, but it gave you a living and, yes, a freedom to paint in your spare time.
Not enough.
If everyone acted like you, the world couldn't go on.
Oh, that's a damn silly thing to say. Everyone doesn't want to act like me. The great majority are perfectly content to do the ordinary things.
And you don't care what anyone thinks of you?
Not a bit.
Are you sure of that?
Absolutely.
It could be that your unconventionality is an attempt to shock, to make a mark with people. People who have some pretensions to unconventionality themselves.
Just to show them, you mean?
That's right.
Show the crowd Amy likes to have around.
Oh, you really
are a young fool. How many more times do I have to tell you I don't give a damn what people think? What motives they impute to me? I don't know what my motives are myself. I only know what I have to do.
And never mind the hurt it does to others.
I can't help that.
And you've no conscience about it at all?
None whatever. Oh, and you can tell Amy it's no good coming after me. I shall change my hotel and she wouldn't be able to find me.
My impression is that she's well rid of you.
My dear fellow, I only hope you'll be able to make her see that.
I was not, I confess, looking forward to giving the account of my mission. However, I could not avoid my duty, and after dinner on the very night of my return, I called to make my report. This time, in addition to the Colonel, Mrs. MacAndrew was present as well, which probably made Mrs. Strickland even more nervous than she might otherwise have been.
Tell us your news, Mr. Moore.
I'm afraid he's quite made up his mind not to return.
Oh.
He wants to paint.
What? Did you say paint?
Yes.
Must be mad as a hatter.
Did you never know that he was keen on that sort of thing, Mrs. Strickland?
Well, I remember before we were married, he did sometimes potter about with a paint box, but you never saw such daubs. We used to chaff him.
Of course, it's only an excuse.
Well, if he wanted to be an artist, why didn't he say so? I should have thought I was the last person to be unsympathetic to aspiration.
You're sure you never encouraged him, Amy?
If he'd had any talent in that direction, I should have been the first to do so. I shouldn't have minded the sacrifice. I'd much rather be married to a painter than a stockbroker.
Oh, my dear, I've no patience with you.
It's true. If it weren't for the children, I wouldn't mind anything. I could be just as happy in a shabby studio as in this flat.
It's ridiculous. You can't possibly believe a word of this nonsense, Amy.
I think it's true.
Oh, come now. A man doesn't throw up his business and leave his wife and children, never mind about becoming a painter, unless there's a woman in it somewhere. I should think he met one of your artistic friends, Amy, and she turned his head.
Yes. What is she like, Mr. Morm?
Ah. There isn't a woman.
What?
No woman?
You mean you never saw her?
There's no one to see. He's quite alone.
That's preposterous.
I knew I ought to have gone over. You can bet your boots I'd have routed her out.
I wish you had gone over. You'd have seen that every one of your suppositions was wrong. For instance, he's not living in a smart hotel. He's living in one tiny room in the most squalid surroundings. And he's hardly got any money.
Here, I say. Do you think perhaps he's done something we don't know about, and he's lying doggo on account of the police?
If that was so, he'd hardly have been such a fool as to give his partner his address. There's no woman. He's not in love. In fact, nothing is further from his thoughts.
Well, if what you say is true, things aren't necessarily so bad. If it's just a whim, he'll get over it.
Yes, why don't you go over to him, Amy? We'll look after the children, and you could stay with him in Paris. Stay for as long as you like.
No, Fred, that's not a good idea.
Oh.
I'd give him all the rope he wants. And in time, you'll see, he'll come crawling back with his tail between his legs. Men are queer creatures. One has to know how to manage them. Perhaps there were times when you weren't very wise with Charlie, but you would entertain...
He'll never come back.
Oh, look, my dear. He's been used to comfort and having someone to look after him. Now, how long do you think it'll be before he gets tired of a scrubby room in a scrubby hotel? Besides...
As long as I thought he'd run away with someone, I'd have believed there was a chance. But if he hasn't gone because he's in love, then it's finished.
Oh, that's a bit subtle. I agree with Dorothy. He'll come back. And I dare say none the worse for having had a bit of a fling.
But I don't want him back.
Amy!
If he'd fallen desperately in love with someone and gone off with her, I could have forgiven him. That would have been natural. I shouldn't really have blamed him. It could have been the woman's fault. But this is different.
Amy, you make me very angry.
I'd have thought it would make things easier.
Don't you see?
I think so. You could have forgiven him if he'd left you for a woman, but not if he's left you for an idea. Is that it?
Yes.
You think you're a match for one, but against the other you're helpless.
I never knew it was possible to hate anyone as much as I hate him. You know, I've been comforting myself with the thought that however long it lasted, he'd want me at the end. And I'd be there, having always loved him, and I'd forgive him. But not now. Now it's finished.
I'm as
indifferent to him as if he were a stranger. If I knew he were dying, I wouldn't care. In fact, I'd like him to die miserable, poor and starving without a friend. I hope he'll rot with some loathsome disease.
Oh, come now, Amy, steady on.
I've done with him.
He says... If you want to divorce him, he'll do whatever is necessary to make it possible.
Why should I give him his freedom?
Oh, I don't think he wants it particularly. He merely thought it might be more convenient for you.
I shall do whatever is least convenient for him.
I suppose you're right to be hard on him. But, you know, I'm not sure that your husband is quite responsible for his actions. I don't think he's himself. He seemed to me to be possessed by some power which is... using him for its own ends.
Which makes him think he's a painter?
Not quite. Now, he doesn't think he's that, not yet. But there is something independent of himself almost, that is driving him to work at becoming one, to work as he's never worked at anything before. In the old days, they'd have said that Charles Strickland had a devil.
All that seems to me very far-fetched. I don't deny that perhaps Amy took him a little too much for granted. If you hadn't been so busy with your own affairs, I can't believe that you wouldn't have suspected something was the matter. But that doesn't prevent the fact that Charles Strickland is a heartless beast. Well, I can tell you why he left her. It was from pure selfishness and nothing else whatsoever.
Yes, I grant you that is the simplest explanation.
But of course it wasn't. In fact, it explained nothing. As future events were to demonstrate.
In part one of The Moon and Sixpence, dramatized in four parts by Geoffrey Siegel, from the novel by W. Somerset Maugham, Ronald Pickup played Maugham himself, and Patrick Allen, Charles Strickland. Mrs. Strickland was played by Margaret Whiting, Colonel McAndrew, Bernard Brown, Mrs. McAndrew, Ellen McIntosh, Rose Waterford, Phyllida Nash, and Robert Strickland, Michael Tudor Barnes. Other parts were played by Helen Atkinson Wood, Arnold Diamond, David Garth, Narissa Knights, Clive Panto, and Hilda Schroeder. The director was John Cardy.